I'm Matthew Petty, and this is Intersection. This Friday, an asteroid the size of half a city block will fly closer to the Earth than some satellites. Scientists say the asteroid poses no threat. Instead, they want to study how asteroids might be mined for minerals that could offer clues to the beginning of life on Earth. Plus, roses are red, violets are blue, and we've got a conversation about love poetry for you. All that's ahead on Intersection. On Friday, February 15th, an asteroid 150 feet wide will fly by the Earth. 2012 DA14 was discovered only last year by Spanish astronomers. It doesn't pose a danger to the planet, but scientists say it will get close enough to get a good look at. To tell us more about the asteroid, I'm joined by Umberto Campins. Professor Campins is a specialist in planetary science and astronomy at the University of Central Florida's Physics Department. Welcome.
My pleasure.
Well, first of all, Umberto, I understand that NASA has identified more than 4,700 asteroids which could pose a danger to the Earth. Is this one of them?
This is not posing an immediate danger. In the future, it could, but this asteroid is not so large that it would cause global devastation. So this asteroid is relatively small. If it will not impact the Earth on this pass, and after this pass, it will actually move away from the Earth, so it's not going to threaten us for at least 30 years after this. But if it were to hit Earth, most of it would probably disintegrate in the atmosphere, but still some small pieces or a shockwave could reach the surface and cause something like what happened in Siberia in 1908, which is called the Tunguska event. But this is not one of the more dangerous asteroids. It is, however, one that is coming by really close, and it's giving us a great opportunity to study it in detail.
I want to go back to something you mentioned before about the asteroid which impacted Siberia back in 1908. What was the name of that asteroid again?
We call it the Tunguska event. We don't know if it was an asteroid or a comet. It's disintegrated in the atmosphere, so no solid pieces were found in the site. But there was this area of Siberia where all the trees were knocked down in a radial pattern. And at the center, some of the trees were left standing up but without any branches. So something came vertically down and pushed the material away. But there was no crater. And there were no pieces, no solid pieces found. So the object that caused this shockwave probably disintegrated in the atmosphere and caused and created this. It took several years for people to even reach the event. This is a very remote area of Siberia. But events like that, we estimate, happen about every 1,200 years. And most of them will happen over the ocean or over unpopulated areas. But if one were to happen over a city, then it can cause quite a bit of damage. So there is an interest in trying to catalog not just the asteroids that can cause global devastation, but some of the smaller ones like this one.
Can you put it in perspective? I mean, 150 feet in diameter, what's that? Can you give us some kind of relative size?
It's half a block. And this object is, in terms of the threat, it's small and it's not going to, it's not a big threat, but it's still large enough that we will be able to identify some of the features in it by studying it with telescopes and radar. And it is, we don't know much about it because it's been far away from the Earth most of the time. It's coming really close. We'll be able to look at it, but right now we don't know what its composition is.
And how close exactly is it going to get to the Earth?
It's getting to within 17,200 miles. And the uncertainty in how close it gets is only about 100 miles. So the closest it can get is 17,100 miles. So there's no chance of it hitting us. But again, this is close enough that it's not just closer than the moon. It is actually 13 times closer than the moon. So it will be closer to Earth than some of the communication satellites.
And can you put that in perspective? I mean, there are a bunch of satellites obviously out there orbiting the Earth. So it will be closer than some of those satellites that are circling the Earth at the moment?
Correct. It will be closer than, for example, what we call the geostationary satellites, which are most of the weather satellites and some of the communication satellites. It will come closer to Earth. It will be about half the distance as those guys.
How often does something like this come around?
For us, it's a first. It's the first time that we've been able to predict with this much time that an object this large is coming this close to the Earth. So this one's the closest one to Earth that hasn't hit.
So you said before you don't know too much about the asteroid, and that's why it's such an exciting event for scientists to be able to get a really good look at it as it swings by. Do you have any idea of what the composition of the asteroid is?
No, we don't, because we have not been able to do detailed spectroscopic studies that would tell us the composition, or even studies that would tell us about the shape, or whether it's a single or a binary asteroid, or if it's a monolithic, in other words, just one rock, or if it's a rubble pile. We will learn about all that during the closest encounter.
So when it comes by, you will get the chance. I mean, I assume you'll be taking photographs of it, or you'll be sort of monitoring it. How do you figure out what an asteroid's made of without, you know, being able to send up a probe and bring back a sample of it?
Yeah, we're not sending up a probe to this one. We're sending up probes to other asteroids, and I'll be happy to discuss that in a bit. But this one is coming by. We discovered it a year ago. Actually, it was discovered by colleagues in Spain. Mm-hmm. And we were preparing for its approach. And what we're doing is that we're looking at it with different types of cameras. We're going to be taking images. We're going to be taking spectra, basically breaking the light from the asteroid into its colors. That tells us about the composition of the asteroid. And we're going to be looking to see if this asteroid is traveling alone, or if it has a moon around it, or if the tidal forces from the Earth itself might break it into pieces as it comes by. If it happens to be a rubble pile and it comes really close to the Earth, then the tides from the Earth could actually break it into multiple pieces as it moves away.
And so are those some of the criteria you use to judge whether an asteroid, one of those 4,700 asteroids NASA has cataloged, whether they're a danger to the planet or not?
Yes. So as a matter of fact, what we learn from this asteroid will probably help us to plan any deflection of an asteroid in the future if one were to be a threat. So one of your questions earlier, is this one a threat? This one's not a threat, but it will help us learn more about how to prepare for ones that could be a threat. For example, asteroid 1999 RQ-36, which is the target of NASA's OSIRIS-REx spacecraft, is a potentially hazardous asteroid. That asteroid is not a threat to Earth now, but in approximately 170 years, its orbit is sufficiently uncertain that it could threaten Earth. So one of the justifications for this NASA mission, which has been approved and will launch in 2016, is to study this asteroid in enough detail so that if we have to nudge it out of the way, that we can do that in another, you know, whatever, 170 years when it threatens us, if it does.
You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 WMFE-FM. I'm Matthew Petty. We're talking to Umberto Campins about the 2012 DA14 asteroid. Are you planning to watch the asteroid fly by this Friday? Let us know on Facebook or Twitter, or email us at intersection@wmfe.org. So you mentioned before that the asteroid we're talking about now, which is swinging by on Friday, was discovered by some astronomers in Spain. Tell me a little bit about how that discovery came about.
The Astronomical Observatory of Mallorca, of the island of Mallorca in Spain, in the Mediterranean, they have two telescopes, or two sets of telescopes, one in the island of Mallorca, and then they operate remotely a set of telescopes in the south of Spain, in the mountains in the south of Spain, and that's called La Sagra Observatory. So they were doing a patrol of the sky, and they discovered this object in February of last year. I happened to be visiting Mallorca in May of last year, and I gave a talk, and they were showing me the observatory, and then they said, "Do you know about 2012 DA14, I said, "Yeah, another asteroid that got discovered." And they said, "No, let us show you." So when they showed me the path, I thought, my God, this thing is coming between the geostationary satellites and the Earth. It's so close. It's going to be a great opportunity to study it. Let's act on it.
I want to ask you about the naming convention for these asteroids. I mean, it's not a very evocative title, is it? 2012 DA14. What does that mean exactly?
It is very useful for us, for astronomers, to keep track of when these were discovered and keep track of these objects. So 1999, or in this case, 2012 is the year it was observed. Year was discovered, and DA14 indicates the week in which it was discovered, and it was the 14th asteroid to be discovered that week. So it indicates then the sequence in which they are discovered. Later, the International Astronomical Union, will accept suggestions and nominations for names for those asteroids, and so they. they will consider a name for somebody who has made a contribution to the field. And I have the honor of having asteroid 3327 named after me. And Dr. Daniel Britt at the University of Central Florida also has an asteroid named after him. So does Dr. Jan Fernandez. So some of our colleagues have had asteroids named after us, which is an honor because that has to be proposed by a colleague to the International Astronomical Union, and then they decide if it's appropriate.
You would want to hope that the asteroid named after you isn't one that's going to cause some devastation to the Earth, though, wouldn't you?
Indeed. The asteroid named after me is very boring. It's in a very stable orbit between Mars and Jupiter. It's not threatening us. Maybe we'll find out some interesting things about it later on when we study it in more detail. But it's not causing trouble.
Do amateur astronomers have some kind of role to play in looking out for asteroids as well as the network of professionals across the world?
Yes, indeed. The technology that is available to amateur astronomers now is remarkable. The cost of cameras and telescopes has gone down, so amateur astronomers have the luxury of having lots of time to monitor the sky. So they can play a role in discovering asteroids, but also, more importantly, in following up on the discoveries so that the telescopes that are dedicated only to the discoveries cannot be also used for follow-up because they need to be patrolling the sky every night. So the follow-up by amateurs can be quite useful so that we get to know the orbit of something that got discovered better and maybe determine whether it's a single or a binary asteroid by discovering how its light is varying. And so there's quite an important role that amateur astronomers can play and do play in this field.
Well, forgive me if this is a silly question, but is it going to be close enough to be able to see through a telescope, for example?
Yes. The thing is, it will be daytime for us, and it will be nighttime in the best place to see it will be Indonesia. So if you happen to have binoculars and you're in Indonesia and it's clear, you'll be able to see it. But it will not be bright enough for the naked eye. Remember, this is only about half a block across, and it's at 17,000 miles away. But with binoculars and small telescopes, you'll be able to follow it. And by the time it is nighttime for us, it will have moved away, but it will still be bright enough for us to do some more observations. And more importantly, we're going to be studying it with radar. From an antenna called Goldstone in California, they will be sending radar signals to get the shape and the rotation rate of this asteroid, thanks to the fact that it comes so close.
Umberto, when people talk about asteroids, they often sort of focus on the potential negative effects of, you know, what if an asteroid hits the Earth? What kind of damage could it do? But there's also an upside to asteroids. Mining companies are talking about the potential for harvesting minerals and other resources from them. And, of course, NASA has said that its new deep space capsule in development, the Orion capsule, could be used to send astronauts to an asteroid before it goes to Mars. Talk to me about the potential usefulness of asteroids.
Yes. In addition to, you know, trying to protect ourselves from the threat of asteroids, the scientific and commercial uses of asteroids are quite attractive. In the case of the commercial use, there's a group of investors headed by James Cameron, the director of Avatar, that is interested in capturing an asteroid and mining it for its commercial value. Of course, scientists are delighted because in addition to the mining, we're going to get all kinds of interesting results about the origin of the asteroid and the history of the solar system and how these things might have started life on Earth. Not that the asteroids have life, but the asteroids have the organic molecules that are the building blocks for life, and we think that's how life started here on Earth. So we're delighted with that. But it turns out that asteroids contain a lot of the minerals that, in the case of the Earth, when the Earth heated up and differentiated, they went to the core, and they're not available on the crust. So an example of that is platinum. So if you go to an asteroid and you mine it, that platinum can be used here on Earth, and it may be cheaper to mine it at the asteroid than to mine it on the surface of the Earth. And interestingly enough, on the surface of the Earth, all of the platinum that we find is associated with impacts of asteroids. So it was not here to start with. It's the asteroids that brought the platinum, for example.
So is there stuff that we're running out of here, minerals and resources we're running out of here on Earth that we could be harvesting from space in the future?
Yes, and harvesting them at costs that are lower than trying to get them here from Earth. In addition to that, asteroids offer a great advantage for space travel. Because if you can go to a near-Earth asteroid and mining it and get, for example, water out of it. You can use that water not only for human consumption, but more importantly, you can break it into hydrogen and oxygen, and then you can use those as fuel to go to Mars or to descend from the moons of Mars to the surface of Mars. And so there are many applications for space travel and for human consumption on the Earth. In on top of the exciting science that we can get from these things, I'd like to point out that three space agencies are planning missions to asteroids where we're going to bring back samples. One of them is NASA's OSIRIS-REx mission, and I'm on the science team of that mission. The other one is the Japanese space agency. It's called Hayabusa 2, which is also going to a primitive asteroid to bring back a sample. And the European Space Agency is planning the Marco Polo R mission, and I'm also working with the Europeans on that project. And why this interest in near-Earth asteroids? It's because here, one of the burning science questions is, how did life form and evolve on Earth? And it turns out that these asteroids are rich in organic molecules. And we know that when the Earth formed, it went through a phase where it was so hot that the surface was molten rock. So we had oceans of lava. And as slowly as the surface cools and the crust forms, it's been sterilized by the heat. So impacts with asteroids and comets bring to Earth the organic molecules that are then allow the origin and the evolution of life. But why don't we just study those organics here on Earth? And it's because once life forms, it erases any record of what came before it by transforming its environment. So we may be able to find out how life formed and evolved on Earth by going to these near-Earth asteroids and bring back samples of what the organic molecules on them are and find out not just how life formed and evolved on Earth, but how life might have formed and evolved elsewhere. So this is just for us a source of riches in terms of knowledge about the origin and formation of the solar system and of life on Earth.
So these asteroids, they're not just chunks of gravel or rock or what have you spinning around in space. They're also sort of like time capsules if you're a scientist.
You can indeed. You can call them space fossils. Yes, they are chunks of rocks and maybe gravel floating around in space, but they have so much interesting information and potential resources.
You're listening to Intersection. I've been speaking with Professor Umberto Campins at the University of Central Florida about the asteroid 2012 DA14. Thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Up next, how to write a love poem. I'm Matthew Petty, and this is Intersection. Well, chocolates, flowers, jewelry are some of the kinds of things you associate with Valentine's Day, but what about love poetry and not just the rhymes in a greeting card? Susan Lilly teaches literature and writing at Trinity Preparatory School in Winter Park and at Rollins College. Her works appeared in Poet Law, The Southern Review, among other journals, and she's won a host of awards for her writing. And she joins me now to talk about the craft of writing a love poem. Susan Lilly, welcome.
Thank you very much.
Well, I want to ask you first of all, Susan, what is the secret to writing a good love poem?
Well, I suppose the thing to think about is to avoid writing the bad love poem. A good love poem is honest, is sincere, it's from the heart. But it's very, very difficult for someone to try to write a poem and not fall into cliche and sentimentality. And that's the road you want to avoid going down.
Why is it so hard to avoid those traps? I mean, is it because love poetry does have such a long history and people have been doing it for so many hundreds of years?
Oh, yes. They go way back, and ever since the troubadours celebrated the tradition of courtly love in the 12th and 13th centuries, you have people celebrating, you know, what we would basically think of today as the emo mode, love as pain, love as unattainable. And the poems that tend to be streaked with a little bit of sadness or fear or loss always tend to be a little more powerful than the ones that are love you till the end of time, everything's perfect kind of poems.
Do you think that love poetry is something that people are more attuned to at certain stages of their life? I mean, you talk about the emo kind of poetry, we might describe it as now. Is it something that you might be more attuned to if you're an adolescent, for example, and you're experiencing all those sort of bold new emotions?
Oh, yes. And some of the great bad love poetry comes from adolescence. But it certainly doesn't take away from the sincerity of the effort. But I think at any age, love poetry is perfectly reasonable and perfectly appropriate. There are those wonderful love poems that are poems of deep appreciation for a long-standing relationship. And even those can avoid sentimentality and cliché by focusing on the details and the real things of daily life. But there's no getting around it that the hot stuff comes from young love, first love, unrequited love, and let's not forget the bitter breakup poem, which is often a love poem in reverse and lots of fun to read and write.
Do you get the sense that love poetry is a bit of a lost art? I mean, are people practicing writing, or are they crafting less love poems now than they would have done a couple of hundred years ago, perhaps, or even last century?
That's an interesting question. You really don't see that many love poems anymore. In fact, I read a lot of literary magazines, and I can count on one hand the good love poems I've seen in the last year or so. And it's always a joy and a great discovery to find one.
Why is that? Why is it not so popular now, do you think?
I think it's that perhaps, if you listen to pop music and you still hear a lot of songs about love, and I think that poets are sometimes, they want to kind of divorce themselves from all sentimentality and cliché, and so sometimes they just avoid the subject altogether. In fact, it's some kind of a radical move to write a love poem these days.
So what are some of the things you should try and avoid if you want to sit about writing a good love poem?
Well, I think you could go through the greeting cards at your local greeting card store or the grocery store, and almost all the things you want to avoid are right there. Clichés, generalities. The worst thing is to have things get all fuzzy and gauzy. A good love poem has real things in it, real things about the love object as well as about life that brings up the image of the loved one.
Do you have a favorite bad love poem?
Oh, my gosh. No, I don't. But there are plenty out there, I assure you.
I suppose, when I think of love poetry, I think back to things like, Shakespearean sonnets, they have a pretty strong structure, and they rhyme, and they have all this kind of internal kind of imagery going on. Quite complex. I mean, is that what people aspire to now when they sit about writing love poems?
I don't think so, but I do think that Shakespeare's sonnets are still popular for a good reason. They are absolutely wonderful. However, even Shakespeare, who followed the rules and wrote what they used to call the blazon, which is the description of the beloved in glowing terms, even he couldn't resist turning that inside out and giving it an edge. I mean, I prefer the poem "My Mistress' Eyes Are Nothing Like the Sun" far above the sweeter ones like "Shall I Compare Thee to a Summer's Day?" I think his edgier sonnets have far more power because they incorporate all the other emotions that come with love, fear, guilt, loneliness. These are all part of love. Love is not the emotion that you feel all by itself. It always comes with other emotions too.
You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 WMFE-FM. We're talking to poet Susan Lilly about the craft of love poetry. I'm Matthew Petty. What's your favourite love poem? Have you ever tried to write one yourself? Let us know on Facebook or Twitter, or you can email us at intersection@wmfe.org. So, Susan, I want to ask you, who are your favourite poets? Who do you turn to when you think of really good examples of love poetry?
Oh, I have lots that I adore. I already mentioned, of course, Shakespeare's sonnets. But I have a poem here that goes all the way back to the 6th century B.C., and I think it's as powerful and relatable now as it ever was. It's by the poet Sappho, who we know very little about. She left only shreds behind. But this is a poem about that particular instance in love where your love object is unattainable. They belong to someone else.
So would you read it for us, please?
Sure. He is more than a hero. He is a god in my eyes, the man who is allowed to sit beside you. He who listens intimately to the sweet murmur of your voice, the enticing laughter that makes my own heart beat fast. If I meet you suddenly, I can't speak. My tongue is broken. A thin flame runs under my skin, seeing nothing, hearing only my own ears drumming. I drip with sweat. Trembling shakes my body, and I turn paler than dry grass. At such times, death isn't far from me.
So what do you like about that poem?
Well, it's not so much about love. It's about how the speaker is feeling when faced with the beloved and the not being able to have the beloved. And it's the sheer physical reaction that the speaker has to being in that person's presence. I think no matter how old you are, you remember a time when you had that reaction to someone, and it's just universal.
Well, let me ask you, I mean, I know that you are a poet yourself and you have a new book out. I'm wondering if you could read some of your own poetry for us.
Well, I have a poem that's kind of a love poem. It's one of my favorite poems because it has to do with the aftermath of a fight between two lovers. So there's always the makeup love poem, which is kind of good. It's also a love poem about a car because when women have a car that they can use to escape with or come back with, it's a very great empowerment. A woman and her car. Gone. Gone in a blaze of taillights and dust, that's me. Dust swirling on the dirt road. Better than horses, it roars. My ally, weapon, partner in crime. Helps me to say I'm leaving and really do it. Floor it, miles in minutes. There's no sense in running after me, so you don't. I exceed the limit, but I won't be stopped. Patrolmen look into their coffee when I streak by. They, too, are terrified of angry women. They don't want to know why. But my car is not afraid. My chariot of fury, my dented silver beauty. My demons are released in little screams with every curve. Later, I'm back in your driveway, honking brazenly for forgiveness. Car idling nonchalantly beneath me. I put on lipstick in the rear view while I wait for you, my laughter spilling out through eyes washed blank with happiness.
So is that referring to something specific for you?
Actually, I was asked this question before, like does this really happen? And whenever anyone asked me about that in one of my poems, I have one answer. And they asked, did this really happen? I say, well, in my head it did. I have to confess that in this case, I kind of stole a conversation that I heard one late night in Denny's at like 2 a.m. And a woman was describing a fight she had had with her boyfriend. And even though I stole it, I completely related to it. And I've had moments like that myself. So I guess it's recreating my own reality using words that I hear in the world around me.
Where do you get your inspiration from?
Well, you can't really wait for inspiration. There's very few times that I am usually driving and something pops into my head that I think, oh my gosh, it's a poem. And usually I try to dig out a notebook there and then at a stoplight, of course, and start writing down notes. But that's so rare. Usually you just have to find the time you have for writing and you have to sit down and be awake and aware and just start writing. Writing is a way of thinking. And if you don't start writing, you may never get to what you actually want to write about.
You're listening to Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. I've been speaking to Susan Lilly about love poetry. Susan Lilly has a new book of poems out called Satellite Beach. Susan, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
The conversation about what's happening in Florida continues online at wmfe.org/intersection. There you can also sign up for our weekly podcast. Support for Intersection comes from our listeners. Amy Green is assistant producer. I'm Matthew Petty. Thanks for listening.